21. Flynn O'Flynn was a busy man during the period of Sebastian's convalescence. His band of followers had been seriously depleted during the recent exchange with Herman Fleischer on the Rufiji, so, to replace his losses, he press-ganged all the Mashiel bearers who had carried them home from Luti's village. These he put through a preliminary course of training, and at the end of 4 days selected a dozen of the most promising to become gun boys. The remainder he dispatched homeward despite their protests. They would dearly have loved to stay for the glamour and reward that they were certain would be heaped upon their more fortunate fellows. Thereafter, the chosen few were entered upon the second part of the training. Securely locked in one of the rondavels behind the bungalow, Flynn kept the tools of his trade. It was an impressive arsenal. Rack upon rack of cheap Martini Henry .450 rifles, a score of W.D. Lee Metfords that has survived the Anglo-Boer War, a lesser number of German Mausers, salvaged from his encounters with Ashkari across the Rovuma, and a very few of the expensive, handmade doubles by Gibbs and Messrs. Greener of London. Not a single weapon had a serial number on it. Above these, neatly stacked on the wooden shelves, were bulk packages of cartridges, wrapped and soldered in lead foil, enough of them to fight a small battle. The room reeked with the slick mineral smell of gun oil. Flynn issued his recruits with Mausers and set about instructing them in the art of handling a rifle. Again he weeded out those who showed no aptitude, and he was left finally with 8 men who could hit an elephant at 50 paces. This group passed into the third and last period of training. Many years previously, Mohammed had been recruited into the German Ashkari. He had even won a medal during the Salitu Rebellion of 1904, and from there had risen to the rank of sergeant and overseer of the officers' mess. During a visit by the army auditor to Mbeyi, where Mohammed was at that time stationed, there had been discovered a stock discrepancy of some 20 bottles of schnapps, and a hole in the mess funds amounting to a little over 1,000 Reichsmark. This was a hanging matter, and Mohammed had resigned without ceremony from the Imperial Army and reached the Portuguese border by a series of forced marches. In Portuguese territory he had met Flynn and solicited and received employment from him. However, he was still an authority on German army drill procedure and retained a command of the language. The recruits were handed over to him, for it was part of Flynn's plans that they be able to masquerade as a squad of German Ashkari. For days thereafter, the camp at Lalapanzi reverberated to Mohammed's Teutonic cries as he goose-stepped about the lawns at the head of his band of nearly naked troops, with his fez set squarely on the grey wool of his head. This left Flynn free to make further preparations. Seated on the stoop of the bungalow, he pored sweatily over his correspondence for many days. First, there was a letter to His Excellency, the Governor, German Administration of East Africa, Dar es Salaam. Sir, I enclose my account for damages as follows herewith. 1 dao, market value, £1,500. 10 rifles, £200. Various stores and provisions, etc., too numerous to list, £100. Injuries, suffering, and hardships, estimated, £200. Total, £2,000. This claim arises from the sinking of the above-said dhow off the mouth of the Rufiji, 10th of July, 1912, which was an act of piracy by your gunboat, the Blucher. I would appreciate payment in gold on or before the 25th of September, 1912. Otherwise, I will take the necessary steps to collect same personally. Yours sincerely, Flynn Patrick O'Flynn, Esquire, Citizen of the United States of America. After much heavy thought, Flynn had decided not to include a claim for the ivory, as he was not too certain of its legality. Best not to mention it. He had considered signing himself United States Ambassador to Africa, but had discarded the idea on the grounds that Governor Shea knew damned well that there was no such thing. However, there was no harm in reminding him of Flynn's nationality. It might make the old rogue hesitate before hanging Flynn out of hand if ever he got his hooks into him. Satisfied that the only response to his demands would be a significant increase in Governor Shea's blood pressure, Flynn proceeded with his preparations to make good his threat of collecting the debt personally. Flynn used this word lightly. He had long ago selected a representative debt collector in the form of Sebastian Oldsmith. It now remained to have him suitably outfitted for the occasion, and, armed with a tape measure from Rose's workbasket, Flynn visited Sebastian's sickbed. These days, visiting Sebastian was much like trying to arrange an interview with the Pope. Sebastian was securely under the maternal protection of Rosa O'Flynn. Flynn knocked discreetly on the door of the guest bedroom, paused for a count of five, and entered. "What do you want?" Rosa greeted him affectionately. She was sitting on the foot of Sebastian's bed. "Hello! Hello!" said Flynn, and then again lamely, "Hello! I suppose you're looking for a drinking companion?" accused Rosa. "Good Lord, no!" Flynn was genuinely horrified by the accusation. What with Rosa's depredations, his stock of gin was running perilously low, and he had no intention of sharing it with anyone. "I just called in to see how he was doing." Flynn transferred his attention to Sebastian. "How you feeling, old bassy boy?" "Much better, thank you." In fact, Sebastian was looking very chirpy indeed. Freshly shaved, dressed in one of Flynn's best nightshirts, he lay like a Roman emperor on clean sheets. On the low table beside his bed stood a vase of frangipani blooms, and there were other floral tributes standing about the room, all of them cut and carefully arranged by Rosa O'Flynn. He was steadily putting on weight again, as Rosa and Nanny stuffed food into him, and colour was starting to drive the yellowish fever stains from his skin. Flynn felt a prickle of irritation at the way Sebastian was being pampered like a stud stallion, while Flynn himself was barely tolerated in his own home. The metaphor which had come naturally into Flynn's mind now sparked a further train of thought, and a sharper prickle of irritation. Stud stallion! Flynn looked at Rosa with attention, and noticed that the dress she wore was the white one with gauzy sleeves that had belonged to her mother, a garment that Rosa usually kept securely locked away, a garment she had worn perhaps twice before in her life. Furthermore, her feet, which were usually bare about the house, were now neatly clad in store-bought patent leather, and, by Jesus, she was wearing a sprig of bougainvillea tucked into the shiny black slick of her hair. The tip of her long braid, which was usually tied carelessly with a thong of leather, flaunted a silk ribbon. Now, Flynn O'Flynn was not a sentimental man, but suddenly he recognised in his daughter a strange new glow and a demure air that had never been there before. And within himself, he became aware of an unusual sensation, so unfamiliar that he did not recognise it as paternal jealousy. He did, however, recognise that the sooner he sent Sebastian on his way, the safer it would be. "Well, that's fine, Bassie," he boomed genially. "That's just fine. Now, I'm sending bearers down to Barrera to pick up supplies, and I just thought they might as well get some clothes for you while they were there." "Well, thank you very much, Flynn." Sebastian was touched by the kindness of his friend. "Might as well do it properly." Flynn produced his tape measure with a flourish. "We'll send your measurements down to old Pabu, and he can tailor-make some stuff for you." "I say, that is jolly decent of you." And completely out of character, thought Rosa O'Flynn, as she watched her father carefully noting the length of Sebastian's legs and arms and the girth of his neck, chest and waist. "The boots and the hat will be a problem," Flynn mused aloud when he had finished. "But I'll find something." "And what do you mean by that, Flynn O'Flynn?" Rosa demanded suspiciously. "Oh, nothing, just nothing at all." Hurriedly, Flynn gathered his notes and his tape and fled from further interrogation. Sometime later, Mohammed and the bearers returned from the shopping expedition to Beira, and he and Flynn immediately closeted themselves in secret conclave in the arsenal. "Did you get it?" demanded Flynn eagerly.
5 boxes of gin I left in the cave behind the waterfall at the top of the valley," whispered Mohammed, and Flynn sighed with relief. "But 1 bottle I brought with me."
Mohammed produced it from under his tunic. Flynn took it from him and drew the cork with his teeth, before spilling a little into the enamel mug that was standing by. "And the other purchases?"
"It was difficult, especially the hat."
"But did you get it?" Flynn demanded.
"It was a direct intervention of Allah."
Mohammed refused to be hurried.
"In the harbour was a German ship, stopped at Beira on its way north to Dar es Salaam. On the boat were 3 German officers. I saw them walking upon the deck."
Mohammed paused and cleared his throat portentously.
"That night, a man who is my friend rowed me out to the ship, and I visited the cabin of one of the soldiers."
"Where is it?" Flynn could not hold his patience. Mohammed stood up and went to the door of the rondavel and called to one of the bearers. He returned and set a bundle on the table in front of Flynn. Grinning proudly, he waited while Flynn unwrapped the bundle.
"Good God Almighty," breathed Flynn.
"Is it not beautiful? Call Manali. Tell him to come here immediately."
10 minutes later, Sebastian, whom Rosa had at last reluctantly placed on the list of walking wounded, entered the rendezvous to be greeted effusively by Flynn.
"Sit down, Bassy boy. I've got a present for you."
Reluctantly, Sebastian obeyed, eyeing the covered object on the table. Flynn stood over it and whisked away the cloth. Then, with the same ceremony as the Archbishop of Canterbury placing the crown, he lifted the helmet above Sebastian's head and lowered it reverently. On the summit, a golden eagle cocked its wings on the point of flight and opens its beak in a silent squawk of menace. The black enamel of the helmet shone with a polished gloss, and the golden chain drooped heavily under Sebastian's chin. It was indeed a thing of beauty, a thing of such presence that it completely overwhelmed Sebastian, enveloping his head to the bridge of his nose so that his eyes were just visible below the jutting brim.
"A few sizes too large," Flynn conceded, "but we can stuff some cloth into the crown to keep it up."
He backed away a few paces and cocked his head on one side as he examined the effect.
"Bassy boy, you'll slay them."
"What's this for?" Sebastian asked in concern from under the steel helmet.
"You'll see, just hold on a shake."
Flynn turned to Mohammed, who was cooing with admiration in the doorway.
"The clothes?"
he asked, and Mohammed beckoned imperiously to the bearers to bring in the boxes that they had carried all the way from Beira. Pabu, the Indian tailor, had obviously laboured with dedication and enthusiasm. The task set him by Flynn had touched the soul of the creative artist in him. 10 minutes later, Sebastian stood self-consciously in the centre of the rendezvous, while Flynn and Mohammed circled him slowly, exclaiming with delight and self-congratulation. Below the massive helmet, which was now propped high with a wad of cloth between steel and scalp, Sebastian was dressed in the sky-blue tunic and riding breeches. The cuffs of the jacket were ringed with yellow silk. A stripe of the same material ran down the outside of the breeches, and the high collar was covered with embroidered metal thread.
complete with spurs, the tall black boots pinched his toes so painfully that Sebastian stood pigeon-toed and blushed with bewilderment.
"I say, Flynn," he pleaded, "what's all this about?"
"Bessie boy," Flynn laid a hand fondly on his shoulder, "you're going to go in there and collect hut tax for—" He almost said me, but altered it quickly to "us."
"What is hut tax?"
"Hut tax is the annual sum of 5 shillings paid by the head men to the German governor for each hut in his village." Flynn led Sebastian to the chair and seated him as gently as though he were pregnant. He lifted a hand to still Sebastian's further inquiries and protests. "Yes, I know you don't understand, but I'll explain it to you carefully. Just keep your mouth shut and listen." He sat down opposite Sebastian and leaned forward earnestly. "Now, the Germans owe us for the Dow and that, like we agreed, right?" Sebastian nodded, and the helmet slid forward over his eyes. He pushed it back. "Well, you are going to go across the river with the gun-bearers dressed as askari. You're going to visit each of the villages before the real tax collector gets there and picks up the money that they owe us. Do you follow me so far?"
"Are you coming with me?"
"Now, how can I do that? Me with my leg not properly healed yet?" Flynn protested impatiently. "Besides that, every headman on the other side knows who I am. Not one of them has ever laid eyes on you before. You just tell them you're a new officer straight out from Germany. One look at that uniform, they'll pay up sharpish."
"What happens if the real tax inspector has already been?"
"They don't start collecting until September, usually, and then they start at the north and work down this way. You'll have plenty of time."
Frowning below the rim of the helmet, Sebastian brought forward a series of objections, each one progressively weaker than its predecessor, and, one by one, Flynn annihilated them. Finally, there was a long silence, while Sebastian's brain ground to a standstill.
"Well," Flynn asked, "are you going to do it?"
And the question was answered from an unexpected quarter, in feminine but not dulcet tones. "He is certainly not going to do it." Guiltily, as small boys caught smoking in the school latrines, Flynn and Sebastian wheeled to face the door, which had carelessly been left ajar. Rosa's suspicions had been aroused by all the surreptitious activity around the rendezvous, and when she had seen Sebastian join in, she had not the slightest qualms about listening outside the window. Her active intervention was not on ethical grounds. Rosa O'Flynn had acquired a rather elastic definition of honesty from her father. Like him, she believed that German property belonged to anybody who could get their hands on it. The fact that Sebastian was involved in a scheme based on dubious moral foundations in no way lowered her opinion of him. Rather, in a sneaking sort of way, it heightened her estimate of him as a potential breadwinner. To date, this was the only area in which she had held misgivings about Sebastian Oldsmith. From experience, she knew that those of her father's business enterprises in which Flynn was not eager to participate personally always involved a great deal of risk. The thought of Sebastian Oldsmith, dressed in a sky-blue uniform, marching across the Rovuma and never coming back, roused in her the same instincts as those of a lioness shortly to be deprived of her cubs. "He is certainly not going to do it," she repeated, and then to Sebastian, "Do you hear me? I forbid it. I forbid it absolutely." This was the wrong approach. Sebastian had, in turn, acquired from his father very Victorian views on the rights and privileges of women. Mr. Oldsmith the senior was a courteous domestic tyrant, a man whose infallibility had never been challenged by his wife, a man who regarded sex deviates, Bolsheviks, trade union organizers, and suffragettes in that descending order of repugnance. Sebastian's mother,
a meek little lady with a perpetually harassed expression, would no more have contemplated absolutely forbidding Mr. Oldsmith a course of action than she would have contemplated denying the existence of God. Her belief in the divine rights of man had extended to her sons. From a very tender age, Sebastian had grown accustomed to worshipful obedience, not only from his mother, but also from his large flock of sisters. Rosa's present attitude and manner of speech came as a shock. It took him but a few seconds to recover, and then he rose to his feet and adjusted the helmet. "I beg your pardon?" he asked coldly. "You heard me," snapped Rosa. "I'm not going to allow this." Sebastian nodded thoughtfully, and then hastily grabbed at the helmet, as it threatened to spoil his dignity by blindfolding him again. Ignoring Rosa, he turned to Flynn. "I will leave as soon as possible. Tomorrow?"
"It'll take a couple more days to get organized," Flynn demurred.
"Very well, then." Sebastian stalked from the room, and the sunlight lit his uniform with dazzling splendor. With a triumphant guffaw, Flynn reached for the enamel mug at his elbow.
"You made a mess of that one," he gloated,
and then his expression changed to unease. Standing in the doorway, Rosa O'Flynn's shoulders had sagged. The angry line of her lips drooped.
"Oh, come on now," gruffed Flynn.
"He won't come back. You know what you are doing to him. You're sending him in there to die."
"Don't talk silly. He's a big boy. He can look after himself."
"Oh, I hate you. Both of you, I hate you both."
And she was gone, running across the yard to the bungalow.